Okay, so I thought maybe as a warm up before maybe the last people appear in the seminar, I'm going to show you an animation. Maybe you remember from last time that what was important in our theory were kind of states which were labeled by graphs. And these graphs are well, it consists of edges, and the edges were somehow labeling holonomies. And you can put this holonomy in different representations, and that's where you get, that's how you get the notion of spin network states. So these are states on which you have edges, and on these edges you have an additional quantum numbers, namely irreducible representations of the gauge group. In this case, it would be SU2. For QCD, it would be irreducible representations of SU3, and so on. In order to understand this film, I have to introduce the notion of a dual graph. Well, what's the dual of a graph? So you take a graph and you somehow intersect each of the edges with a surface. And when you do this, you get something which is called a cell complex. So it's a cell complex has a vertex of the original graph in its center. So this film will not show you the evolution of a spin network state. It will of the graph, but it will show you the evolution, the quantum evolution of this dual cell complex. And in order to represent these spin quantum numbers, we have colored the faces by colors, and these colors come in discrete colors. So it's not a continuum of colors, but there's a discrete step somehow inside. And then the physical interpretation of these spin quantum numbers is that they give you the area, the area eigenvalue of the area operator associated with the faces of this complex. So it's
evolution in what sense or under what?
These are the quantum Einstein equations. So this is when you try to solve the Hamiltonian constraint, this is what would you get.
Is there a scale of less time or what?
Yeah, what is time?
No, this is, well, this film doesn't talk about matter degrees of freedom. You could introduce them as well. They would sit at the vertices of this graph.
So you're taking a state, you apply the Hamiltonian and see what it goes
right
to, in spite of the fact that it's a constraint.
These aren't physical states. You just keep applying that.
That's right.
And see what happens.
That's right.
So there were external time, then this would be physical.
Wait, before you do it, and which definition of the Hamiltonian are you talking about?
Well, this is an animation, so this is not a simulation. Okay, a simulation would be much more complicated, but this is just in order to get an intuitive feel for what is happening.
Okay. But this is a definition where the topological structure of the graph doesn't change, only the values of the strings change.
You could think of it as that way, but it doesn't need to be.
But it is your Hamiltonian.
It is my, yeah. For instance, edges or faces can appear or disappear, can be created or annihilated. And this happens only when the edge has the lowest possible spin. So there's some information about the details of the dynamics is encoded in this animation. So I hope it will work. Doesn't work.
Is it on your screen right now?
It's on the screen, yeah.
Can you go into it and turn off the hardware at the light?
Can you show me how to do it?
Right click on the background of the screen.
I can't stop it while it's running, so I can show it like this. But
yeah, they want to see.
Not for me. I've seen
it. So the story behind this film is that in the year 2005, it was the Einstein year, and our somebody managed to get a grant which was, I think, worth of 80,000 euros, and somebody created that film for us. So it's
so two things are happening. It's changing in time.
And you're zooming through it or something. So you're flying through a quantum space-time, and you see that the colors on this face are changing all the time. So this is corresponds to creating and annihilating spin quantum numbers all the time. Well, we are flying through this, so you can say it's zooming in and zooming out. Yeah.
Is this one of these Marcus Purcell annotations?
Pardon me?
Is this one of these animations that Marcus does for the website, or is somebody else?
No, no. This is these are professional animators.
Oh, yeah, I see. Great.
So this was done on 24 Pentium 4 parallel processors. So it's so we'll try. Maybe we can try later again. So I'm going to try to cut this down to half an hour or so. So today we are coming to the second notion of singularity resolution in loop quantum gravity, which is about curvature singularity resolution. And in order to so in Abai's theory, I mean, in this loop quantum cosmological context, we could do this in a very precise way, talking about physical states. This is very difficult to do in a full theory because we would really have to construct or have sufficient control over the physical Hilbert space. We know that it exists, so to say, but we don't have explicitly the physical states in front of us. So in order to do this in a full theory, at the moment we have to work with approximations, and the tool to do this are so-called coherent states. So by coherent states, I mean by this minimal uncertainty states for this holonomy flux algebra. So you construct states such that the expectation value of the holonomies and of the fluxes are recovered, and such that the minimal uncertainty relation is saturated. And so these states are labeled by a classical connection and the classical electric field. And if you choose this point in the phase space to be on the constraint surface, then it's true that, for example, the master constraint is approximately zero in the sense of expectation value, and also that its fluctuations are small. So in a sense, you could say, okay, this is something like an approximate physical state. Because what this means is that the norm of M applied to this coherent state is squared is equal to zero, approximately equal to zero. So this is the shape of the states when you restrict them to just one edge. And here, so this is the overlap function. So you take two of these coherent states, and you take the scalar product, and you take the norm of that scalar product. So this number that you get will never be greater than one. And you see that there's a nice Gaussian shape here, and what I'm displaying here is the electrical direction in the phase space, and this is the magnetic direction in the phase space. We see that there, in order to specify the state, I have to introduce a scale, a length scale. And this length scale somehow has something to do at which scale I would see wiggling effects or non-smooth effects in the quantum geometry. And before I introduce dynamical information, I don't have a natural value for this scale L. Maybe it's something like the cosmological constant, but at this moment, we don't have a natural value for this L. It's certainly something else than the Planck scale. It has nothing to do with the Planck scale.
You said at the moment. What's the
suppose that I give you the usual quantum mechanical phase space. It's the usual phase space for a particle. Mm-hmm. Just you have Q and P, and somebody asks you to construct minimal uncertainty states for Q and P. Then you can do that, and probably by natural, quite naturally, you are led to the usual harmonic oscillator coherent states, but you wouldn't know what the scale is. So if I don't give you the mass of the harmonic oscillator and the spring constant, then I can't form this natural m omega, which is something like L squared. But if I have, for example, a physical Hamiltonian, I probably would get a natural value of L.
So you expect that once we incorporate the Hamiltonian constraint, it will in some sense pick out a value of L?
I don't think it's the Hamiltonian constraint that we want to use for this, but the physical Hamiltonian. Because, I mean, after all, one of the reasons why we look at kinematical coherent states at all is in order to check whether the quantization of the Hamiltonian constraint and the associated algebra is in some sense correctly represented. And this, of course, doesn't make sense to test on the physical Hilbert space because, by definition, everything is zero there.
Could L change from point to point? Or is that
actually, it does change from
it
point.
Does change.
Yeah, in general, it does change from point to point.
Is that in the imaginary part of A that's indicated in the argument in the R sign? What is that symbol in front of A?
Okay, so here this is. So I said that this is for a single edge. So for each edge, you have a three configuration degrees of freedom associated with the holonomy, and three momentum degrees of freedom. So here, this is the case that I truncate my gauge group from SU2 to U1 just for purpose. I mean, I would have to draw a six-dimensional plot, which I can't. So imagine that I'm talking about U1 instead of SU2.
But you're working with a real connection.
Right. That is just, yeah. So if I would talk about U1 instead of SU2, so we can construct, the story is like this, so we can construct this kind of coherent state for any compact gauge group, in particular U1, SU2, SU3. So this would be the plot for U1. And that makes sense to take the imaginary part. For SU2, you have similar plots, but I would have to slice through the phase space and convince you that all these plots are peaked. Anyway, so in order to talk about things like the semi-classical limit and in order to give you specify these coherent states, what I need are the following data. So I need to know into which spatial manifold I have to embed my abstract graph. And I need to give you, of course, a point in the classical phase space. That is to say, initial data on some on this differential manifold, and this classicality scale.
Question. So, the graph is something you just fix for all. Well, at the outset, and you just keep it fixed, or
the abstract graph is fixed once and for all. But you can embed it in all possible ways into the spatial manifold that you pick, and all these different embeddings will give you different states.
Mm-hmm. And what about some notion of graph independence if you pick one graph as opposed to another, or sort of a canonical way?
The quantum algebra is graph independent, but the number of states that you get will depend on the particular embedding of this abstract graph. So what we have shown, and this is work with Christina Giesel, who is in the audience, is that the expectation value of the master constraint, for example, coincides with the classical value up to corrections in this parameter, which can be very, very small if you choose a very macroscopic length scale. This is the distortion. Actually, you see here that the Gaussian has a certain width, and the width is the square root of this quantity. That's the value of the width. No, I mean this, we have analytic formulas for this overlap function, and the plot, of course, is using Mathematica just to plot this formula. It's not numerical; it's analytic. So this is a proof, at least, that the infinitesimal operators are correctly implemented, and this is an off-shell calculation.
Why is that last statement following the previous one? Does this imply that, for example, the algebra of constraints is closes?
So by a calculation similar to, you're right, I mean, it doesn't follow from that formula, but by a calculation similar to that one, you can also consider the algebra of constraints and calculate their algebra.
But in particular, one of the things you might like to say that the gain-perceptual gain transformation is for the gauge, is for the algebra to close at least to all orders in the Planck square, not just to the leading order.
Yes. I mean, that would be the ideal thing, and this is related to what I said last time, that we would like to implement now techniques from lattice gauge theory that help you to improve the algebra to push this result from h bar to the zero order to all orders.
Okay, but for the moment, this is really just h bar.
For the moment, this is h bar to the zero.
Mm-hmm. Can I ask you again to speak on the velocity? The impression I had was that L is the scale at which sort of quantum fluctuations of the geometry appear.
Uh-huh.
And so I would have thought that is actually close to the Planck scale, but when you went by that, I don't know, that middle line, you said if L is very far from the Planck scale, you do small corrections.
Right.
Where, in your sort of intuition, where is L?
Suppose that I'm an LHC person, and I don't want to see any quantum geometry effects at the LHC. Then I would say that I would pick L to be maybe slightly lower than 1 TeV.
So it's a Coase gradient scale.
Yeah.
It's a scale of Coase gradient.
But that's then a matter of choice.
At the moment,
this is a matter of choice.
Right. So at the moment, it's a matter of choice. But then, in nature or in your ultimate theory, you thought it was going to be picked out by the physical Hamiltonian. And
right.
So what's your intuition there? It's going to sit at some low scale or some high scale?
I don't know offhand how I should think of this macroscopic scale in terms of maybe masses or whatever you have in the standard model. But I could imagine that L is ultimately formed by or determined by this kind of input.
So field theories of gravity wouldn't apply above L because you wouldn't have the usual field theory of quantum fluctuations in the metric?
Wouldn't apply above L?
Yeah. I mean, you're saying that the quantum fluctuations in the metric are cut off above L, but in field theory, pre-gravity is a field theory, it fluctuates up to the Planck, fluctuates, up to the Planck scale.
So the fluctuations become, they are important somewhere around where this parameter becomes of order unity.
Right, but I think Joe's idea is that the usual concepts that we use in field theory are going to apply below longer distance scales than L.
Yeah.
And so in some sense, that L is serving as what we might call a cutoff in the theory. Above that, space-time all goes to L, and the techniques we would want to apply don't apply there. But below that...
Yeah, maybe that is it's a useful way of thinking about this L, that it's something like the end of where you have pushed your normalization group transformation,
yeah.
And the physics above L is what you get.
And your reason to think it's below the Planck scale, not say within a factor of 10 of the Planck scale.
I would think that L is of the order of the ultimate L would be maybe of the order of the Planck scale. I mean, this is.
So
again, why would that be selected by the dynamics as opposed to by the choice of the state or some other choice? You did say that you think it's selected by the dynamics.
So what we are trying to construct here are coherent states. So in a sense, these are states which are not only minimal uncertainty with respect to some degrees of freedom, but also which should be such that they don't disperse under the quantum evolution. But the quantum evolution has to have an input, namely some kind of Hamiltonian. And as you well know, if you want to try to construct such states, then you have to use the information from the dynamics in order to ensure that the dispersion doesn't grow very much over extended amount of time.
But you normally look for the ground state to find that non-dispersing.
Well, that's one particular coherent state.
No, not for every particle. You look for the scale on which you want to do things.
Right, but if you take an experiment,
you say you don't want to disperse much between the time you emit the wave packet and the time it scans.
That's a single particle. He's talking about states who differ in sort of everywhere in terms of the amount of fluctuation they have. It's not right. As you change L, you're changing the state everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's.
That's true.
Yeah.
Okay.
Well, I think that's an interesting idea to somehow relate this scale L to this kind of renormalization group ideas.
Well, also that's kind of suggestive that if you do push L up to a border L prime,
yeah,
that you lose control of the corrections.
Yes, of course. Yeah. So.
But also the statement would be that the theory you can't do it. I mean, if you go back. So this is my point of view, so mm-hmm. You
may
not agree. Okay. If you go back to Tess' ideas about just looking at the vacuum state, some of these Hamiltonian will be vacuum state. And in that vacuum state, really, you cannot have excitations which are arbitrarily close to each other. They really are going to be separated by some multiple of one plank, or 10 plank plank. One can show that.
That's not a Lorentz invariant statement.
Right. So I think that's why I'm making it the heuristic level, right? Exactly. So I mean, the statement would be. I'm agreeing with you that it is not the way I said it. The reason it's not a Lorentz invariant is really because it's like if you give yourself a vacuum state, for Maxwell field, for example, it's a Gaussian. And so there are uncertainties in E and B at the same time. So here there are also uncertainties in E and B at the same time. Now if I make a kind of Lorentz transformation, then E's and B's get mixed up. Okay? So same thing is going to happen here. So I'm telling an answer in sort of a given frame. Okay, because and then the statement is that really that L could not be taken smaller than some multiple of the Planck scale. The vacuum state will actually come with the naturally built-in cutoff in this particular way.
I mean, mathematically you can still construct those states, but the fluctuations wouldn't be small. I mean. That's exactly, I mean, that's expected that the semi-classical approximation breaks down when you come close to the Planck scale.
Okay. One reason why I get puzzled about this, and this is connected to the Lorentz invariance question, if you have some wave of some random wavelength moving through this room, you can always boost that to get that to have a wavelength that's less than the Planck scale by an arbitrary amount, just by going to some reference frame that's sufficiently boosted. So, I guess part of the question would be, do you have to throw that kind of thing out in this approach or not?
But if you boost something to an arbitrary energy scale, then of course, operationally, what you have to do, you have to specify what kind of, you're probing, then you're really probing something at very high energies.
In a sense, if you really try to probe it by colliding something with it, you are.
Sure.
Yes. If you have the kinematics of Lorentz transformations, then you should have a description in this frame where it's the wavelength is a centimeter, mm-hmm. you should have the description in another frame where it's
right.
a millionth of a Planck length.
So the coherent states, for example, for the Maxwell field, there's one coherent state, a particular one, which is the ground state, which is Poincaré invariant, and the other ones are not Poincaré invariant. And if you would try to boost a given coherent state, which refers to some reference frame, and you do that, then you get a different coherent state, and of course the dispersions will change.
This is the mixing of EMB.
This is exactly the mixing of EMB.
It would still make sense when you boost by an arbitrary amount or not.
I would have to look up the formula. I think that the uncertainty relation will still be saturated. It's just it will be more and more squeezed the state. Okay, now this was kind of preparation, so the tool with which we can do something in this very preliminary stage in the full theory. And now I want to give you some very crude definition of what we might mean by singularity resolution. And this slide would try to do it in the perfect world where you have complete control over all the physical Hilbert space, the physical observables, and so on and so forth. So I would try to do something which is very similar to what Abai was doing in his model, and which also Martin did in his model. Prepare a physical state peaked at some Friedman, Robertson, Walker initial data, very isotropic and homogeneous. At late physical time, let's say today, and then quantum evolve this state with a physical Hamiltonian backwards in time. Then you monitor physical operators, the expectation value of physical operators in this physical and evolved states, and try to see what happens when you push this physical time parameter to the Big Bang time. So remember that OF was a Dirac observer, which is also invariant under the gauge transformations generated by the Hamiltonian constraint, and here I'm picking a particular observable which would certainly detect curvature singularities in the classical theory and which is spatially gauge, spatially diffeomorphism invariant. So this thing is now 4 diffeom invariant.
What is tau in your picture
now? Tau is a physical time parameter.
You mean you have some matter field or something which is giving that?
Yeah.
I mean, there is, maybe this isn't the time to bring it up, but I mean, going back to our original discussion the uh-huh. first day, I mean, it's not clear that this is the definition one wants to use for...
It's not clear, no. It's not clear.
Because you could have a situation where a state has well-behaved evolution for all time.
Well, this
observable blows up.
Well, the state, of course, has always zero unit norm. The state is always well-behaved because the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint.
Okay, so in this case, the state would always...
State is always fine, yeah. But
and it could have a nice semi-classical region on the other side.
Right.
But if some observable like this blew up, you would still call it singular.
Yeah. And this would be now a Lorentz invariant statement because this operator is invariant all under all gauge motions.
And what about some high power of the curvature? I mean, would you require all observables?
You pick whatever criterion you want to choose. I mean, this is a very simple, the simplest thing that you can try. I mean, if you look, for example, in Walt's book, he has a long discussion there with what you really mean by singularity resolution, and there's a paragraph which says that, well, you could mean that some curvature invariant should go up, but this is not always a good measure of singularity, because you might also mean that some geodesics stop at a finite amount of time. So that's not even classically it's clear what you mean by singularities. I'm just giving you one possible definition.
But in this case, I mean, singularities, we think of it as a place where the theory breaks down, classically.
Yeah.
So, in this case, would you say the quantum theory is breaking down there?
Well, if this operator blows up, then I would say that even the quantum theory, the thing, is singular.
Why would you say that? Hamiltonian is self-adjoint, the dynamics is well defined.
Yeah, but the operator expectation value still might blow up.
To pretty easily, there's a bit of semantics. In what sense is the theory breaking down?
Well, this is this is an observable quantity, right? So,
yeah, but so is 1 over x squared in quantum mechanics. And I can have a nice state where 1 over x expectation value of 1 over x squared blows up at some time, and I don't say anything nasty is going on.
This is really something like curvature square off. I think that I'm really looking at homogeneous model is a scalar curvature off.
Sure, but this gets back to Gary's question of, what you know, blow up should we regard as being fatal, and what should we regard as,
I do think that energy has to be considered, carefully. I do not think that supposing there's actually a singularity, you just change your time parameter, make it log the original time parameter, and then the singularity is pushed at infinity. And I can just say, well, I've got a Hamiltonian evolution, which is perfectly well defined. Just take, for example, Wheeler-Levitt equation in this mini superspace approximation.
Yeah.
But it illustrates the point.
It illustrates the point.
And in that case, if you just use scalar field time, it does go to minus infinity of the singularity. And therefore, one will find that, in fact, just like in a classical theory, if I use log proper time as being my time variable, that the singularity is pushed back at minus infinity. But nobody will say that therefore the singularity is actually at minus infinity. But in that case, we actually have some classical states. So you start with this universe play times, which is semi-classical, you walk out. It is semi-classical, so I do have a good excellent approximate notion of proper time. And then I find that singularity actually is approaching proper time. And so, just because the evolution is unitary, that is to say, in this time, the singularity is being approached at infinite past, doesn't mean there's no singularity, for the same reason as in classical relativity. But this is the point that I really feel that is important, that just because of the unitary evolution by itself, I don't think that this tells us too much. And this is a thing that we had a discussion, of course. We have to understand the observables better in the whole question.
Well, I agree that having a unitary evolution does not mean it's non-singular, as you just described. Having observables diverge, I think, doesn't mean it's singular. I mean, let me ask the question this way. Suppose you find, you don't find this, but suppose you did find that the observables in expectation value had some finite expectation value that diverged at some, let's call it tau equals zero, and then it was finite again. Okay. The same was the theory breaks down. Does this mean that you wouldn't trust the prediction that for tau negative, the observables are finite again?
I would like to translate the question into physical time. Right? And then the question is, in that physical time, is the evolution well defined? Yeah. Not in some parameter.
But suppose in the physical time.
But he meant the physical time, right? Meant the physical time.
By physical time, I mean the proper time. It might be defined only in some semi-classical context, because otherwise I would not know what semi-classical time means. Let's go on. In the state, we just speak this. So if, in fact, the evolution is unitary, in what we would call, if the state actually evolves in a unitary way for the entire range of what we would call physical time, and I call it, then the evolution is not non-zero.
Even with some curvature observable blowing up at some time.
Because, again, the statement is only that expectation value is going down.
So I think we're all in agreement with on it. So it's not.
But there's a little conference that we shouldn't agree so readily that. I think this actually does touch on a really profound point. I mean, we could measure our proper time with different types of clocks.
Right.
And each one in the quantum gravity theory would be a different system. And it might be that for some of those, we could evolve through without anything blowing up, and for some we couldn't. So in fact, I really think it is not so clear, actually, still, how we want to define what it means for the thing to be, for the theory itself to be singular.
The clock is supposed to be part of the system. It's not an external clock.
Right. I think that Ted meant even intrinsically, if you have different choices of clock, then still. Strange things might happen. I mean, in some ways.
There may be no good choice of clock.
Also, that maybe.
But in the semi-classical thing, so you're saying that in the semi-classical dramatizers consider different observables whose proper time, for one, the proper time is going up,
Well, actually, I was thinking not semi-classically, but just at the fundamental level of quantum gravity theory. So I'm actually not saying, I mean, I wish I didn't have to say it, but so I find myself just not knowing, it's even with a gun to my head, how to tell somebody what we're really talking about here. And I'm not offering an alternative either.
You have to know by Monday, right?
So what's the bottom line? What did we say? Just if the Hamiltonian is well defined, or the it's unitary all the time, then we are fine, or is that the conclusion? Or?
I mean, I would be happy with the statement that if there's unitary evolution for all sort of physical time in some sense. We have some time, we can evaluate something classically, it looks like it's good, whenever it's well defined, we have good evolution. If some observables blow up, then it would be a prediction of the theory that, well, maybe the observable is just, you know, not well defined there, or getting, you know, bad, or, you know, maybe the evolution is just getting really big there. But not that the theory is breaking down.
I agree with that. But the test point is also the attacking, because in all our statement, there is this, you know, what is it got to say?
What is that?
So I agree, we don't know.
Yeah. But in classical relativity, it's not just that curvature is blowing up, it's that that prevents Einstein's equation from being evolvable. I mean, you could have some, you know, classical initial data that's, I don't know, C2 but not C3, and some, you know, higher order gradient of curvature is going to blow up, but you don't care because we have a theory that says you can keep on evolving. And so as long as the quantum theory says you can keep on evolving...
Yeah, the only caveat was just that you have to choose that space.
Yeah, okay.
But I'm a little bit confused, because suppose that, we have unitary evolution, but all possible operators that you might observe are blowing up. What happens then?
Possible.
Yeah.
Well, there's always going to be something that doesn't blow up.
Like, well, a sufficiently large set of operators. I mean, that separate the points of the observable phase space. I mean, after all, I want to observe something, and if something goes really bad in some sense.
No, I think just like in relativity, we're not classed by such, you know, quote unquote singularities. I mean, I would not call this singularity, but I don't know what's a good name for it. So one would just say that this is a problem.
What do you think inverse tangent of your set of observables? Reparameterize them.
Sure. Yeah. So, I mean, it's bad news for whoever, you know, tries to go through that singularity, but it certainly sounds like the theory knows how to go through the singularity.
I'm not sure whether I would agree with that. Okay, so this would be the ideal scenario. Now we come to the things that we can do at the moment. So
the precise statement I was is singularity avoidance if all of these expectation values remain well defined. Was that not?
The majority in this audience seems to be of the opinion that whenever you have an essentially self-adjoint Hamiltonian with respect to some clock time, then
the physical time, not some time. Mm-hmm. Yes.
Well, the physical time that is induced by the clock, right? No, I mean, the clock induces a physical time.
But for example, the Friedman Robertson Walker models, right? The scalar field,
uh-huh,
we take as a clock. The right. Scalar field basically behaves roughly in the open model, just like log of the proper time.
Right.
And so if you are, I mean, certainly then the in the scalar field clock, you could call that clock. And the singularity is cheaper to minus infinity.
You want to say that the physical clock, the clock variable that you choose should at least classically have a proper behavior.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
But, I mean, if you're close to the singularity, my intuition would seem to tell me that even the very notion of a proper time may not make sense anymore. And then what is...
Yeah, there may be no physical time that makes sense. I don't know why one would assume that there is.
So the statement is that, I mean, at least I know how to talk about singularities reasonably and ambiguously only in these states.
You have a well-defined time, a clock field. that stays well-defined, even though where you have this would be singularity. But suppose you didn't have that.
I think it'd be hard to tell. Right? The statement is then, the notion is, previous statement was ambiguous about what it means by physical clock. And in this case, it might become even more ambiguous. And so I don't have a general, completely blanket definition here. So in cases, it is ambiguous. In some other cases, it might be ambiguous.
But if there's an evolution from one semi-classical region to another, then it's not ambiguous, right? I mean, then it's simple because we may not know what proper time means near the singularity, but we know what proper time means both sides of the singularity, far from the singularity, and then we're okay. We just say the quantum theory knows how to go from this semi-classical region to this semi-classical region in a totally unique way, and that's all we care about.
Yeah, but Harman is more concerned about something just fizzling out, and then I do not know what he's talking about.
Yeah, so then there really might be an ambiguity in the question of whether the singularity is resolved or not. But if it actually goes through to another semi-classical region, then I think there's no ambiguity. Mm-hmm.
Okay, so the reason for why I was mentioning the coherent states for the purposes of this seminar was that we are coming now to what we can do at the moment. And this is only an approximate check. And it's even debatable in what sense that approximation is a good approximation. So what we now take are not physical coherent states, but kinematical coherent states. And what we do, we of course peak them on the constraint surface, and we also peak them, we consider a one parameter family of coherent states, which are such that they are peaked on a classically singular trajectory. So think of a Friedman, Robertson, Walker universe. You peak some initial data and you evolve them, and you hit at some point, you have hit a singularity, and I mean that the coherent states are now peaked on that classical singular trajectory. So as I said, these are only approximate physical states, they're not really physical states, but they're peaked in particular at the value or the expectation value of the clock field would be Prost close to this parameter tau. Now I have a closed formula for this Dirac observers, and I also have something like a power expansion in terms of tau minus phi. And what I can do now is, instead of monitoring things with respect to physical states, I can monitor with respect to this approximate physical states. And I get a power expansion in tau minus tau naught, where tau naught is, say, the Big Bang time. And what I'm now interested in, since I was talking about curvature singularities, I'm interested in this kind of expectation values that appear here. So these are now operators in a kinematical Hilbert space that I can probe with these kinematical coherent states. And essential for the singularity resolution of this kind of operators is a certain Poisson identity, which I now want to sketch here. And it has to do with the volume operator, or the prominent role of the volume operator. So maybe you remember that the dynamics, or the operators that determine dynamics, like the Hamiltonian constraint or the Master constraint, contained inverse powers of the volume operator. And it so happens that the volume operator has a huge kernel. So it's not just one state or two states. There's an infinite number of states on which the volume operator has zero eigenvalue. So this kind of operators would be badly divergent on this kind of states, and in mathematical terms, the operator wouldn't even be densely defined. And the way we go around this is to use the following classical identity, which relates the co-triad integrated along a certain path to the following Poisson bracket between the volume, classical volume function, and holonomies. And this formula is exact up to orders of epsilon, where epsilon is the parameter that I use to integrate my path. And now we can quantize this formula. And what we just do is to replace, so you see here that the Newton's constant appears. So when we quantize this, we replace this Poisson bracket by a commutator divided by I times H bar. That's why there's an 1 over LP squared appearing here. And this technique is essential in order to turning M and as the master constraint, the physical Hamiltonian and other operators of a similar kind into densely defined operators. And it's also at the heart of this tremendous success of the loop quantum cosmology approximation of loop quantum gravity. So for example, there's a simple model, the isotropic and homogeneous one, and you can talk about something like a curvature operator in this models, which is related to inverse powers of the scale factor. And in that model, the scale factor actually is a bounded operator. It's not only densely defined, it's even a bounded operator.
Thomas, epsilon here is what again? You're integrating the triad over some small path?
Yeah, so if I would embed my graph into a spatial manifold, then epsilon would be the parameter length of an edge that I have. So, and epsilon becomes arbitrarily small when I embed my graph in a very, very fine way.
Isn't the coefficient of epsilon an operator?
Sure. If you take this expression and plug it into, I mean, look at first at this classical formula here, and then so the way you do this is the following: you take the classical integral, you approximate it by a Riemann sum, then you put in these quantities instead of this quantity, and then you consider the limit as epsilon goes to zero, and these correction terms go away in the limit as epsilon goes to zero when you take the limit of the Riemann sum going to the integral. So that's fine. So now in the full theory, the only so far analysis that has been done is using the Einstein inflaton model, and here the bothering term would be the kinetic contribution to the inflaton Hamiltonian, which in a homogeneous situation would go like pi squared over a cubed, which is singular. Now what we do is we consider coherent states which are peaked on this classically singular trajectory, and now I have to extend the phase space to include only the gravitational but also the inflaton degrees of freedom, and what we calculate is, for example, this expectation value. So now let me discuss the results in to some extent. And this relates to the question that Don was asking the other time. So in the isotropic and homogeneous model, this kind of operator was actually bounded operator. And in this work, we wanted to ask, how much survives of this in the full theory, at least in this approximation. And what we found is that even on zero volume eigenstates, the inverse scale factor operator is not bounded. So, and of course, one has to ask this in a isotropic and homogeneous context. So the state that we chose is very, very simple. You take a simple graph like this. You take a gauge invariant state. So there's gauge invariants at both vertices, and then you take a lot of them. And you distribute them in a homogeneous and isotropic way over all of your spatial manifold so that you get an approximately homogeneous and isotropic state. And it's true that the volume operator everywhere vanishes on the state. So that's a zero, it's really a zero operator eigenvalue state. And here are some unbounded configurations. So Q is an abbreviation for this complicated Poisson bracket kind of operator. You see that here we have fixed J1 and J2 as a function of J3, and you see that the eigenvalues increase with a power which is slightly bigger than unity.
I'm sorry, I missed something. So your Poisson bracket identity was reproducing the triad or some sort of inverse, right?
It's something I could try it, yeah.
Okay, so how does that explain the 1 over the multiple?
I'm sorry, co-triad, co-triad.
Oh, it's like a co-triad.
Co-triad, yeah.
Okay, so it's like giving you the inverse.
Yeah. And more general matter has more general coupling between matter and gravity, and the same trick applies with different powers of the volume operator appearing in the commutator. So this it works for all kind of standard matter at least. So here's the fine structure of this spectrum of this Q operator, or the eigenvalues in the expectation values in eigenstates. So we see that something strange happens here. But although this shows that the operator in the full theory is not bounded, this is not the relevant question to ask. The relevant question to ask is that we want to study the behavior or the singularity behavior of this operator in states which somehow have a semi-classical interpretation, at least at large scales, which approximate a Friedman-Robertson-Walker universe. And what we found is that nevertheless, although the operator is not bounded from above, the expectation value stays bounded, and stays bounded with a bound which is of the order of the inverse Planck area. So there's good and bad news. And the good news is that this kind of calculation somehow also takes care of inhomogeneities and isotropies. On the other hand, it is only an approximation in the sense that I indicated. So it's less the result is less relevant from the point of a physical Hilbert space picture.
But you're assuming the inhomogeneities and anisotropies are small right up to the singularity.
Well, this we pick one of our states, and we put in some length scale. And the fluctuations are small, are of the order of Planck area divided by L squared. So for a cosmological context, it would be fine to choose L of the order of a Hubble length or something, and then the fluctuations are extremely tiny.
But then as you go towards the singularity, they're not going to remain tiny.
Right, and still...
In fact, that you should overwhelm all of this Robertson-Walker stuff.
Exactly, and nevertheless, the expectation value stays bounded.
Thomas, I somehow got lost. You started out with a physical state.
Right.
Meaning a state that's annihilated.
Exactly.
And now somehow you're no longer talking about physical states, are you?
Yes, so I've said that from at the beginning that there's this ideal way of doing things that you can do in Martin's and Abbe's models. And there's in the full theory we can't do that right now because we don't have control over the physical Hilbert space yet. So this is the only thing that we can do so far. Just to mention that a similar calculation can be done also for Schwarzschild black holes because of this nice mathematical fact that you can map the inside of the black hole to a Kantorff-Sachs model for which also this result pertains.
Mm-hmm. You're saying, in contrast to FTC, you probably mean just the isotropic model where you cycle with the boundedness of the temperature.
That's me. That's right.
Because inhomogeneities and isotropies have also been...
Yeah, I mean just the homogeneous and isotropic case. Yeah.
But FTC doesn't appear just to isotropy because it's anisotropic.
But this result also, goes beyond isotropy and homogeneity. So the next step in order to improve this calculation would be to evolve kinematical coherent states with physical Hamiltonian, which is something that we are trying to do right now. So let me finish what should be done, and hopefully can be done, is we want to get more control over the physical Hilbert space. We want to have a perturbative definition of observables and the physical Hamiltonian. We want to know what exactly, how good this approximation is that we were doing here. And then there are these other things that came up last time, and maybe we want to make contact between loop quantum gravity and say with the semi-classical approximation, namely quantum field theory on curved space-time. We want to know what is the relation between randomization group and screening effects to what we are doing here. And quantum cosmological perturbation theory should be something that is in our reach now. Thank you very much for your attention.
Resolve as far as the idea of a bouncing scenario. I mean, you say that the curvatures are still, the excitation values are finite and you evolve your coherent states in this way, but they reach Planck scale values. So, I mean, one of the interesting results that Alvar was telling us about was that in LQC, at least in some levels, you get these bounces where everything remains sort of semi-classical during the whole evolution. What do you think is going to happen in a more general context?
Less. Well, I don't know enough, but what one would hope to see is that with respect to the physical Hamiltonian that I was looking at here, something similar would happen in the full theory, but it's of course very hard to answer this at the moment. I mean, we have to control an infinite number of degrees of freedom, not only a few of them. It's quantum field theory.
Just a couple of comments in stone. Directly answer the question more than what Thomas but still clarifies it. Namely that, now, first of all, as Martin said, LQC, this is an isotropic model, also particularly an isotropic that I can look at in some detail.
So, these anisotropic models, the bounces depend, there's not just one bounce, about any time curvature scalar becomes one scale. Then there's a bounce. So the structure of the bounces is much more complicated than in simple model that I showed. But also in the isotropic model, the statement is that quantum cosmology, the statement is that
the density operator, which is like a curvature operator, there is no upper bound on that. Density operator.
You say density operator, you mean one over volume operator? Inverse volume
operator? P5 squared upon inverse volume.
It depends on energy density, right?
So because of energy.
Rho.
Because of matter. P5 squared is large, so there's no upper bound.
So the same thing that we looked at here, P squared over square root of determinant of Q.
Right, but because P squared can be added large. So it's just similar to
the thing about the.
So the statement about this curvature is bounded by this Planck thing. If you look at the full hyperspace, that is going to be the case. But if I now look at some semi-state, which is semi-classical ending, that's why there's a statement of, which is just a thematical kind of statement, and then there's a statement about what happens in the evolution of the polyphasic. And if you take a state which is semi-classical ending, then it never reaches, so to say, the curvatures which are less than the Planck scale, and it bounces much like before.
But Thomas was trying to do something like that here. He thinks there's a semi-classical state. There's not as much control in this context as I don't see it, I understand. But.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
So in the classical theory, the space derivatives become negligible compared to the time derivatives as you go towards the singularity. In the quantum treatment, do the space derivatives become important again as you go towards the Planck scale, or do they remain unimportant?
After this workshop, this is one thing that I wanted to look at, so I don't know yet.
But to be fair, you need to set up coordinates appropriately for it.
Sure.
That's not the problem.
Yes. Yeah, okay.
It's invariant, so you have to use foliation, there's a parallel product, but you could use transport. But
yeah, so it's for example.
Long,
sure.
It's a long.
Well, and you know there are going to be states for which, I mean, in some sense, there's a kind of a cutoff here at the Planck scale, right? There's no structure in the quantum gravity below the Planck scale of distance. So you know there will be states where you never enter the velocity dominated regime, right? For a given given the classical initial data, you only get velocity dominance in the right models sufficiently close to the singularity. So if I set up the singularity such that, in some sense, the classical evolution wouldn't get to the velocity dominated regime until you closer to the singularity in a Planck way, you don't really expect to ever see that velocity dominated regime in a quantum dominant.
Well, you have to dial things very, very carefully to make a state like that. Most states won't do that. But yeah, but it can do it. Sure. Yeah.
With enough dials, you can do anything.
Yeah. But I mean, if these spatial derivatives do remain negligible even in the quantum regime, in this theory, then in some sense you would expect the general singularity to reduce to what Morton has already told us happens in the homogeneous case, and we'd be done.
I have an intuitive objection to this bounce idea, which I just want. I mean, maybe I should wait for Martin to go. Maybe this. I mean, you super said you get better control, but see, the one thing that bothers me, and this sort of came up in work I was doing with Thomas, and is that in a mini superspace approximation, it's easy to imagine a bounce. You have very few degrees of freedom. You know, they do something like going off to infinity near the singularity. You can imagine some self-adjoint extension or Hamiltonian something, and which brings them all back. But the minute you go to the full theory, you know, you have all these other degrees of freedom which can get excited, as you were saying, near the things. You get all this Planck scale degrees of freedom turning on, in some sense, it's entropy increase near the big crunch. And now a simple bounce would seem to require some violation of the second law. You need to have all these microscopic degrees of freedom come back into some nice, smooth, homogeneous space-time. So it seems like it's, you know, that's a problem.
Well, maybe you're taking too strict a definition of bounce. So what I would expect is to set up before the bounce very smoothish conditions.
Sure.
And then what I would expect to see later on, after the bounce, is a state in which all of the fluctuations are excited, hopefully to a finite amount. So the evolution is not time symmetric. So again, you could also set up final conditions and run them backwards. And so the equations are time symmetric, but the states that you would choose would not show time symmetric evolution.
But you get a semi-classical space-time with a lot more fluctuations after the bounce than you had before.
But as I thought and understood that already...
Where you smooth out the bounce.
But as far as I understood, that happens also in your model, right? The dispersions grow some...
Yeah.
So it already happens.
It already happens in the k equal to 1 model, right? The dispersions.
So the problem is if the fluctuations blow up at the point where the homogeneous model bounces.
Also, just as a side remark, I mean, the statement is that normally, you know, like Penrose type idea that it's similar, that the initial state is very special. Now, I think it is true that this bounce point is very special. I don't know. It is, you know, the space of extension can be zero, there is very interesting thing happen there. And it is true that if I just look at the classical theory, that trajectory which are kind of fits for the expanding universes. So this is actually a repeller for the other universes, is actually an attractor. So there is something special about this bounce point, and that is replacing this heuristic Penrose kind of idea. But I don't want to say, I do not know what is going to happen when one takes the full theory. By no means I want to say it's obvious that, you know, that the bounce will actually persist or something. I think Martin has some interesting.
I think a lot of weather versions involve how one perceives bounds and information in this model, and there's the same ones. I don't have any strong evidence so far that they do bounds in some simple way. I said, so they just kind of, it may be qualitatively different, you said, with our easy
engineering. That was it.
Yeah, I have a different question. Unless your question first, please.
Yeah, so couldn't you just be concerned with how one might resolve a singularity, or if you would, you know, if you didn't get a bounce or something that semi-classically looked like you somehow got something that would have classically been singular but now isn't, you would say it was still singular.
No. I mean, there's a couple of options. You could have evolution in the quantum sense, which in a state which just doesn't describe some semi-classical space-time anymore.
Right.
So that would be, I mean, the quantum theory would still, you know, be fine, but there wouldn't be any semi-classical space-time.
But then you would define that to be a type of resolution of the singularity. I don't see why that isn't just.
No, that's fine. One of the possibilities. I guess I was just objecting to the simple bounce picture because.
We don't know the simple function. But yeah, so the statement is that there could be a complete prediction quantum behaviors. So quantum states have a well-defined evolution, so that in that sense there is no singularity. But the state is not at all semi-classical. It fizzles out completely and becomes a quantum form. And that is something like that happens. Then one would like to say that, well, somehow, you know, the Big Bang is a kind of approximately a good event, an interesting event, even in quantum theory, because, so to say, soon after what people, classical people said for the Big Bang, classical space-time was born. And before that, classical space-time was fizzled out. So it is still a birth of the classical universe from kind of a forming picture. But if this is what happens, I would actually be the tunnel into others.
I have a somewhat different question, because in this whole discussion of singularity avoided, somehow what played an essential role is to get some notion of time, whether proper time, whatever, to evolve, and then either an expectation that it evolves up or something else wrong with the state. But how would you describe singularity avoidance in the frozen time formulas, or in terms of we had a Witt equation, we have not chosen any classical time variable. I just give you the Witt equation, you find a solution, which is supposed to have a solution of this equation, exact solution of this equation. How would you see in terms of that wave function of the universe, whether this is a situation that describes singularity avoidance or not? Is there any essence?
Yes. So, I mean, this whole issue about looking at the scalability of time, and I think Jim is not here. So it's not necessary at all. I mean, I just want to sort of emphasize again and again that the scalar field of time is totally irrelevant to the whole quantum description. It is just that it is much more intuitively obvious in this kind of presentation or understanding of what is happening in terms of time.
How do you see it in the photo?
So what we have is just a solution to the Wheeler-Levy equation. Okay, with the scalar field here in this case is what we have. Just a solution to the Wheeler-Levy equation, which is, you know, and that's it. And I can ask many questions. I can ask, you know, there are many Dirac observables. One Dirac observable could be, you know, what is if the volume of the universe at a given value of the scale if it was so and so, what is the volume at some other time? Okay, that's one Dirac observable. But other Dirac observable could also be, if the value of the scalar field and the volume was such and such a thing, right? Then what is the value of the scalar field and the volume is twice that way. So I mean, it's completely, there's really no notion of time that is really needed. What is needed is really Dirac observables here.
But this is exactly what was happening here, because you remember that there was this physical state psi naught, which is the solution of all the constraints, and then you have this Dirac observable, which are called OF, which now depends on tau, but tau is really the scalar field value. So this is exactly what.
That's one way of doing pure gravity, and I'm not. I don't want to couple it with scalar field. Then what would I consider?
I need something here, right? So
for example, I just wanted to talk about vacuum short shield, for example, or just pure gravity.
Mm-hmm. So if you're looking at vacuum short shield, then if you talk about that specific example, then one can, for example, go close to the singularity, and in the close to this, I mean, inside the horizon, basically, and then there is a slicing. Right, the standard slicing, which is actually homogeneous slicing.
This is what I was saying.
The distant task is slicing, it's homogeneous. And then the statement is that kinematically, there really are 2 degrees of freedom. Kinematically. One is, so to say, the norm of the time like kinematically, which is the space line. And the other is the area of the sphere. Mm-hmm. And so, again, you don't need time. That it's really, you're asking correlations between those two. But again, it is much more convenient to think of the scalar field as the area as being a time coordinate. And when the area goes to zero is when you get the classical singularity. And you can describe things in terms of, think of marching in time steps. But this is just, you know, we're just using classical intuition in order to talk about this thing. But I just to come back to Hermann's question, I mean, as Ted pointed out some time ago, that in complete generality, we don't really know what singularity avoidance is. It's only in those cases where we have some kind of semi-classical state where we can talk about, you know, where we know classically something happened, like we know singularity, and we can say that the quantum state can evolve, quote unquote, across it without any problem.
So you would say, if I understand you correctly, you have this solution in the frozen time formalism, and then it just depends on what class of Dirac observables you look at, and then you study the behavior of these Dirac observables as functions of some other.
Right, as in the classical theory. So I should be able to pinpoint, in terms of these Dirac observables, what happened that there was a classical singularity. You know, there's a class. So, and now, this is what I meant. Now, if I have a semi-classical state, I can again use the same ideas. And if, in fact, there's no more singularity, then I would say the singularity is resolved. But if it turns out that the state is completely fuzzed out, then I don't know.
But I'm confused, because there are now two notions of singularities. Maybe something blows up, or some observer blows up, or I have a self-adjoint Hamiltonian, or maybe even essentially self-adjoint Hamiltonian. So what's the agreement now?
I mean, well, I don't think observables blowing up should define singularity. I mean, it's,
but this
said,
is
I mean,
but
it's
this
ordinary quantum mechanics.
But this contradicts what Abai just said. Why?
So okay, let's start.
But the essential issue, the real question I think we all want to ask is our physical theory, whatever it is, complete in some sense?
Okay.
Now the trick is, I just said in some sense, and we need to explore whether the sense in which a given physical theory is complete is an interesting sense. So I think your task as a person developing the theory of quantum gravity is to write down a full theory. Try to write down a full theory. Write down, if you like, just a big Hilbert space for the constraints to act on and a well-defined set of constraints that are essentially self-adjoint or whatever is the appropriate generalization thereof to a Dirac algebra. If you have that, you've got the full theory. There's you know, you can calculate everything in that theory. The theory doesn't break down in any obvious sense. Then it's your task to tell us that there are these solutions to these constraints and the observable series properties. Now let's interpret that. Let's try to understand what the theory is telling us about the evolution of the universe.
So
any theory that's defined, that's fully defined, has a big Hilbert space and a set of constraints that are appropriately self-adjoint, will be complete in some sense. It still is somehow up to us at the end to decide if this theory satisfies us intellectually. I mean, in the sense that, let me just restate in this context Abai's earlier example. If I was doing the Willard-Witt equation or something, quantum cosmology, I can write down a Hamiltonian constraint which is self-adjoint in terms of the usual Willard-Witt variables by just multiplying by an appropriate power of the scale factor such that the classical closed Hamiltonian vector field just run towards A equals zero and stop. Like I can make the Hamiltonian complete by just sort of, in effect, rescaling it so it doesn't generate translations in sort of proper time anymore, but rescaled by the scale factor. Intuitively, that kind of way of developing a complete theory seems unappealing. In retrospect, I think one would say it's not obviously wrong, but we probably wouldn't, it doesn't sound very satisfying. I mean, it's possible that the fundamental theory, whatever it is, just tells us that the universe ends at something that is at a point which is finite in some naive generalization that we think of as being proper time. So I don't know. You can write down a theory, and in the end, if it's consistent and a nice theory of quantum gravity, and it predicts lots of things for us, and we can test it experimentally, then. Really,
suppose I take classical Maxwell theory, and
yeah.
I have certainly solutions in that theory which are incomplete in your sense, because you have an electron which runs into the nucleus of a hydrogen atom, and I, for example, I could detect it by measuring the energy of the atom and of the electron. I would see that it blows up.
It's an incomplete theory, as you say. If you tried to write.
So now I do the same thing in the quantum theory, and I would still see the same thing. It doesn't happen in this case, but.
Suppose the Hamiltonian would still be not self-adjoint.
Suppose the Hamiltonian is self-adjoint.
Is self-adjoint.
Yeah. And still, the energy blows up. I mean, the electron energy blows up.
Then what happens to the evolution? The evolution also should come back, I don't understand.
Yeah, I mean, none of these issues arise in regular quantum theory because there is a preferred notion of time, and then the question is, you know, given the state, can we evolve it for arbitrarily large?
No, I know what you mean. The total energy, of course, stays finite. But, for example, the electric piece could.
You mean, suppose we lived in six dimensions and you wrote down the theory of the hydrogen atom where the Hamiltonian was unbounded in the model.
Uh-huh.
In fact, the naive operator is not essentially solved. That would be a complete theory. It would seem like it would be unstable and therefore unlikely to correctly reproduce the experimental results we have of stability in the real world. It would be a complete theory. And if you could show that it passed the experimental test of reproducing stability of hydrogen atoms, then we might know this. I think at some levels, we have to get down to just define a theory, make some predictions that we can hopefully test experimentally, and then we'll see.
Okay, I think we should call this quits because we have to reconvene at 2.
Bring your laughter, and we showed a movie at the beginning of my talk.